Case number 19-7162 et al. Wayo Technology, Inc. versus Republic of Iraq and Ministry of Defense for the Republic of Iraq appellants. Mr. Morag for the appellants, Mr. Katyal for the appellees.
All right, Mr. Morag, good morning.
Good morning, and apologies for the delay. May it please the court. I'd like to start with the subject matter jurisdiction issues, if I may.
Good.
This case is a single cause of action for breach of contract. That contract is the broker services agreement, which called for Wyoke to refurbish military equipment, construct repair facilities, and decommission equipment for scrap sales, all in Iraq, all of Iraqi military equipment. It was negotiated in Iraq, signed in Iraq, and is governed by Iraqi law, and critically, Wyoke was to invoice Iraq in Iraq and sought to be paid in Iraq. And it is that breach, the breach of contract alleged in the complaint and found by the district court, was the non-payment of invoices in Iraq. In light of that, the Fourth Circuit's ruling sustaining an immunity exception under Clause 2 of the commercial activities exception cannot stand as law of the case after the Supreme Court's decision in OBB versus Sachs, and it was clearly wrong at the time it was issued in 2011 as well.
Mr. Moore, can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Are you suggesting that it would be law of the case if you agreed with the substance of the ruling? Do you concede that it's law of the case, but that you're saying these exceptions apply, that we shouldn't do law of the case because it isn't correct or because there's an intervening decision, but absent those, you would believe this to be law of the case?
Yes, Your Honor. As we lay out in our brief, and it's undisputed, I believe, the law of the case doctrine applies initially. The issue of intervening change in the law and a determination by this court that the Fourth Circuit's decision was clearly erroneous and created a manifest injustice are described in your case law as exceptions to the doctrine. We think both apply. And what that does is that permits you to reconsider the Fourth Circuit's decision. And when you do that, you would be applying the de novo standard of review.
Almost nothing else appearing, though. The Sachs decision from the Supreme Court clearly must be the controlling Supreme Court precedent would control over law of the case, would it not?
Yes, it is. Yes, it would. And that's why the Supreme Court's decision is intervening, controlling authority.
Exactly.
What you've said in McKesson 2 was the standard to determine whether it affects your reliance on the Fourth Circuit's decision is whether it's material to the outcome. You would just look at the Fourth Circuit's decision today after Sachs and decide if it's still good law. We submit that you can only come to one conclusion on that question, and the answer is no. This court is very familiar with Sachs. You applied it only 2 months ago in the JAM versus IFC case to make this exact same determination on what conduct is a claim based upon. And here, the Fourth Circuit's decision cannot stand because the Fourth Circuit decided that this breach of contract claim was based upon administrative tasks that Wyoke performed in the United States in connection with the broker services agreement. But that cannot be the gravamen, the foundation, the core of the claim, because of two things that the Supreme Court reiterated in Sachs, which other circuits, including this one, had misunderstood before Sachs. And those are that the gravamen is the conduct that actually injured the plaintiff. And it's the conduct which, and therefore you have to look at what the plaintiff needs to show in order to prevail, proving that Wyoke conducted administrative tasks in the United States entitles it to no recovery from Iraq. Indeed, as Judge Lambert's lengthy opinion shows, the basis for Y-Oak's recovery in this case was proof that Iraq breached a contract to pay the pro forma invoices in Iraq, and then the attendant damages that Y-Oak suffered in Iraq.
So, Mr. Morag, I'm more concerned, I think, about sort of other issues related to law of the case, one of which is the peculiar circumstance of the Fourth Circuit having decided this to begin with. And what I'm trying to understand is why shouldn't your client be made to live with the consequence of its decision to appeal the Fourth Circuit's decision, notwithstanding the fact that the case had been transferred? It seems to me you bore the risk that the Fourth Circuit would rule against you because you sought to appeal rather than just go with the fact that the case had been transferred and work through the system at the DDC and now this court. So we're in a sort of peculiar situation in which you're suggesting that a Fourth Circuit opinion on a legal issue somehow binds us in this context.
Well, Your Honor, the case law is clear, and the Christensen case in the Supreme Court was a situation where you had the Federal Circuit decision being considered law of the case relative to the Seventh Circuit. We would be in the exact same position if Y-Oak had filed this case in the district court in Washington. The district judge had rendered the same decision as the Virginia judge, we would have taken interlocutory appeal, and you would have rendered the same decision as the Fourth Circuit.
Well, let me ask you, can I test that hypothetical? Because that's another sort of odd aspect in terms of your initial concession that law of the case applies. My understanding is that the Fourth Circuit ruled on a motion to dismiss, that they were determining whether the complaint contain sufficient allegations, if true, to sustain a claim against the defense of immunity. And they said, affirmed the district court judge that you did not have immunity, but on the complaint at the motion to dismiss stage. Suppose there was no transfer, the Fourth Circuit's decision stands. Is it your position that the district judge in the Eastern District of Virginia would not have been able to revisit the immunity decision during or after trial?
Your Honor, the answer is that the reason we said what we said in our appeal brief is because there's a decision by Judge Roberts in this court that explains that what happens when you make a motion to dismiss on sovereign immunity grounds at the outset is the court looks at the complaint allegations and makes an initial determination whether they state a immunity exception. The Fourth Circuit said they did. At trial, we were not able to, because they're not really disputed, to contradict the factual allegation that Y-Oak did perform some administrative tasks in the United States. That was not a factual dispute.
Right, but I'm asking you a different question. I'm asking you whether the law of the case doctrine would prevent the district court from revisiting that determination at a later stage in the litigation, regardless of whether or not they would have agreed with you on if you'd re-raise the immunity question. I want to know whether the Fourth Circuit's decision would be law of the case on the district of on the Eastern District of Virginia on that issue.
Yes. It would, and as well as the mandate rule. And the mandate rule applied to Judge Lamberth as well, because the Fourth Circuit is an appellate court in the federal system. The transfer did not change the relationship between the appellate court and the district court in terms of the Fourth Circuit's decision.
But isn't the Fourth Circuit's decision only about the motion to dismiss? I would understand if Judge Lamberth were asked, as soon as it came to him, you refiled a motion to dismiss and you made the same arguments, then I see law of the case. What I don't understand is why, if a district judge is asked at a later stage of the case about immunity again, the Fourth Circuit's opinion on immunity precludes that.
The Fourth Circuit's opinion itself discusses that it would be law of the case, notwithstanding the transfer. It's the majority decided it would be. The point is that the Fourth Circuit decided based on a factual assumption, it accepted as true one fact, that YO performed administrative tasks in the United States. The only way the district court, within the rubric of your question about the motion to dismiss, could have come out differently is if it found those facts not met. What we are saying is that the facts were established, but they still do not, they do not, as a matter of law, satisfy Wyoke's burden of pleading an exception to the immunity of Iraq, which Iraq invoked and re-invoked after the Fourth Circuit's decision came down in its answer. It has preserved the issue, and you are the right court to decide whether, either because of intervening Supreme Court authority or the Fourth Circuit's decision itself at the time was clearly in error.
Well, we don't need to do anything about the Fourth Circuit's error or non-error if we agree with you that Sachs states the law governing this case and Sachs intervened since the original Fourth Circuit decision, then the Fourth Circuit decision is no longer binding as law of the case, even to the extent the law of the case is usually binding.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Okay. That's correct. And that is why we it appears that Wyoke is looking for alternative grounds to substantiate the court's jurisdiction and has not identified those either that comply with the FSIA. The waiver argument that they raise is without basis because there was no Iraq preserved the issue of its sovereign immunity. It certainly did not unambiguously, unmistakably, through any conduct post the appeal, affirmatively waive and indicate to the court and to Wyoke that it was no longer contesting immunity and was conceding the court's jurisdiction, as your precedents would require a finding under the implied waiver exception under
16. What about direct effects, Mr. Morick? What about direct effects? We have this other clause, even right. If we agree with you that based upon means based upon the gravamen of the suit. The gravamen of the suit is the breach. They also argue that the breach has caused direct effects in the United States. Why is that wrong?
Okay, well, first of all, on that, there is no law of the case issue. It's a de novo, it would be de novo consideration of an issue the district court never even decided. So the direct effects fail for the same reasons that they failed in any number of cases. The direct effects are not direct, and were not felt in the United States.
But if the district court didn't decide it, why wouldn't we just send it back for district court consideration in the first instance?
Well, it was fully briefed before the district court and it chose not to, for the same reason the Fourth Circuit chose not to. These are issues that this court can resolve on its own. It did that in Bell Helicopter versus Textron. You just look at the allegation and it's a legal question
Direct effects is a legal question, not a question of fact as to what happened in terms of what's going on in the United States.
When the facts are not disputed, it's a legal question of whether the facts alleged satisfy the test of being directly a direct consequence of the sovereign's breach.
But we're beyond allegation. We had a trial. And my question is, why wouldn't we let the district court look at the record and determine based on his understanding of what happened at trial, whether there were direct effects in the United States?
Your Honor, that is an option you have, but I think when you look at what is alleged as a direct effect, you essentially have considered these types of arguments in other cases and have affirmed that they are not direct effects.
How about McKesson? Why is this case not closer to McKesson than it is to Zidane? It isn't just the payment of money. You had the operation running from somewhere in Pennsylvania. You had the folks who were doing all this scrap stuff over there of necessity, but it was being run from Pennsylvania.
Because, Your Honor, McKesson involves a situation where the plaintiff was a investor. It owned part of the plant that was expropriated. This is simply a contractor who, a U.S. contractor, who had some of its employees in the United States and was performing administrative functions here. It is not, there was no intended performance from the United States. This wasn't a contract to supply U.S. goods or anything like that. It was a contract with that the only connection is a U.S. Contractor who by necessity had employees and operations in the United States.
Well, yeah, but these people who were doing all this scrap work over in Iraq, they had to get their directions from the people in Pennsylvania. That is, what to scrap, what not to scrap, and so forth. They were basically, if you had the contractor analogy, they were the people in Pennsylvania were the contractor, and the folks in Iraq were the subs or the, you know, the carpenters and so forth. I don't see why this doesn't have a direct effect and why we shouldn't send it back. I think Judge Lamberth was wrong on the commercial activity, but this is a vast record. He can take another look at it under the third clause and reach his decision.
Well, Your Honor, if I'm permitted to respond, I think that what you describe is true of every U.S. contractor case and not distinguishable. The decisions about what to scrap, what to refurbish, were all to be made in Iraq between Y-Oak's personnel there and the Iraqi Ministry of Defense and the U.S. authorities. This is not a situation any different from the many cases which involved no obligation of payment in the United States and no anticipated performance in the United States. This is really Helmrich and Payne, which you more recently ruled on, and there is no McKesson connection because of the absence of any interest in any business in Iraq, which is what
McKesson. What about the potential interference with the other contracts that they were trying to make in the United States? I thought there was some allegation or evidence of a relationship with other businesses that was interfered with precisely because the Y-Oak said, we haven't been paid yet for these invoices and the like.
Yes, Your Honor, and Judge Lamberth made an explicit finding that the subcontract with CLI, which was the company that was supposed to do the construction work, had not been signed, had not been entered into. And that was a factor that this court in Helmrich and Payne specifically relied upon as to why, therefore, any effect on subcontractors was not a direct effect because there were
not an effect on subcontractors, right? They didn't have the contract yet. I'm talking about an effect on Y-Oak. We have a tort that is interference with business relationship, right? That's a well-established thing that if you're developing a business relationship with someone and another person comes along and interferes with that, that's a harm. So what I'm asking is, why isn't it the case that Y-Oak was affected in the United States by the alleged interference with its relationship with CLI because of the breach?
Your Honor, that is a theory that Y-Oak has never pleaded, not before the district court, not before this court. There is no tortious interference. Iraq breached a contract. There is no tort claim against Iraq in this case.
I'm not saying they have to make the elements of a claim because all we're doing is looking for direct effects. And I'm just suggesting that it's no answer to say, but they didn't have a contract with these other people. Exactly. They didn't have a contract, they say, because Iraq breached the agreement. And so why isn't that a direct effect? We were on the verge of making a contract and we weren't able to do it because of the breach. And that, and the contract we would have had was in the United States. Why does that not count as direct effect?
Because that was the precise argument raised in Helmrich and Payne, that the Helmrich and Payne would have entered into the subcontract but for Venezuela's breach. And that didn't work there. What worked in Carnival Cruise Line was a situation where the subcontracts were an integral part of, and Canada was, the contract clearly contemplated these US subcontracts. And so that was considered a direct effect. But absent the actual contract, there is no direct effect because it just doesn't count. It's not direct, and there's an attenuation that this court has said breaks the causal chain.
All right.
All right, if there are no more questions, then we'll hear from you, Mr. Katyal.
Thank you, Judge Henderson, and may it please the court, Neil Katyal for Wyoke. As General Petraeus testified, Wyoke and Iraq entered into a commercial contract with massive military and diplomatic importance, but Iraq refused to pay what it owed, and Wyoke's CEO was brutally murdered while he was trying to collect that payment. Now, before this court, Iraq doesn't dispute it breached the contract, nor does it dispute that Wyoke suffered damages. Yet Iraq is saying it should pay nothing, and that's wrong. On jurisdiction, they must overcome four independent bases: waiver, law of the case, the merits of the second clause, and the merits of the third clause. So Judge Henderson, even if you think the merits of the second clause cut against us, there's still three independent things they'd have to run the table on.
Now, why don't you concentrate on the third clause?
Sure. So I think what you just heard my friend say on the other side about the third clause is that we never argued anything about CLI and the withdrawal. No, absolutely. We isolated four different direct effects in our briefing below. By the way,
I know it's Judge Henderson's question. I'm going to say, enumerate those four direct effects, please.
Absolutely. The first was payment to a United States bank, which we designated. The second
isn't that something that would be normally appearing in contracts between the United States entity and a foreign sovereign, so that you're writing the direct out of the statutory exception, aren't you, if you say that's enough?
No, Your Honor, I think direct just refers to, is there any sort of intervening cause? Here, the contract itself with the sovereign gave Wyoke the ability to pick the place of payment, just as actually the contract in Weltover did. And there's no intervening cause. Wyoke, under the agreement that Iraq signed, agreed to use the Pennsylvania bank. And so that is a direct effect. Now, I know you might not feel it's substantial, but the Supreme Court in Weltover said that's not the test anymore. So that's the first direct effect. The second is the one I was referring to with Judge Henderson, the cutoff of capital and personnel. And we litigated this below, and they put in zilch, not a word, which is why we think they've waived all of these sovereign immunity arguments, not just on clause two, but on clause three as well. We argued, and this is at Joint Appendix page 573, something the district court found, that because Iraq breached the contract, that cratered the agreement with CLI. We had a verbal agreement, they were performing under the agreement, but they needed a guarantee of financing. And that's certainly enough, as Judge Henderson, you were talking about with McKesson, enough to qualify as a direct effect. The third direct effect, and this is one I understand you, some members of the panel have disagreed on at various points, is the targeting of a US corporation. Our argument here below was that Iraq specifically targeted a US company it knew would feel the loss in the United States. Wyoke isn't some random company. They were handpicked by the US military and the intelligence community to do this kind of work, this very specialized work.
Targeting by whom, though, Mr. Katyal? Targeting by whom?
Targeted by Iraq for breaching this agreement. So Iraq knew that by breaching the agreement, it would cause pain in the United States. The agreement itself recites that Wyoke is a United States company. And the disagreement that two members of this panel had in EIG was about whether or not there are intervening causes at issue in that case. Here, there are no intervening causes. Iraq breaches the agreement that directly harms a United States company.
I'm not sure that's all of our disagreement, but perhaps it's at least part of it.
What is the evidence that it was the Iraq's intention to target this company? I mean, it just seems circumstantial that it happened to be a U.S. company, but where's the evidence in the record of actual maliciousness in terms of targeting of a U.S. company?
Again, I don't think it needs maliciousness, Judge Jackson. I don't think that's a test. It just requires targeting. And here, Iraq knew that Wyoke was a United States company and performing a critical mission. The agreement itself recites just how critical this mission is to the United States and to Iraq. It's critical to, for example, the withdrawal of United States forces. General Petraeus and the testimony referred to by the district court on this, I think, is very telling. So
I thought your targeting was argument was more about this Zaina or whatever, the more of a fraud argument, that Zaina was a crook all along.
That's part of it, Your Honor, but it isn't the only part of it. It's also just the cutoff of funds that withdrew, the refusal to pay a huge bill to a United States company. And then the fourth point is the diplomatic effects and all of the stuff that we isolate, the immediate consequences of geopolitical effects that by withdrawing from this contract, it had massive impact on United States personnel, United States foreign policy, and the like. And our most important
record,
point
to you— Does the current record really bear that out, or and what's your position as to whether or not we should send it back so that Judge Lamberth can take a look at that?
Absolutely, Judge Jackson. They don't get another bite at the apple. I mean, we litigated this for pages and pages, even though sovereign immunity is their burden. And I think this court, Judge Sentell, your opinion in Belize Social Development, and the court's opinion in Al-Haddad says, you know, they bear the burden of proof. And if the evidence is in equipoise at all, you give the doubt against sovereign immunity. Here they made zilch of an argument in the district court. And Judge Jackson, this book brings me to the law of the case argument or waiver arguments. I think however you want to phrase it, as this case came to the district court, they picked the Fourth Circuit. They said the Fourth Circuit decisions would control. You even heard my friend again today say something very similar. And now in the district court, what do they say? They give you a whopping one sentence. They give the district court a whopping one sentence on sovereign immunity with respect to everything, clause 2 and 3. And that is at Joint Appendix page 505. Quote, the court shall determine its jurisdiction accordingly.
But Mr. Kripal, can I just tell you that I sense some tension in your argument on this point. To the extent that the Fourth Circuit's argument or decision was law of the case, which I am struggling to see, but assuming that it is, then how is it that Iraq can be faulted for not seeking to revisit that vigorously once the case was transferred? It seems as though everybody agreed that the Fourth Circuit had bound them with respect to this issue. So I don't know that we can suddenly say, well, because they didn't re-raise it and have a whole long brief about it, that they now have somehow waived it.
So Judge Jackson, this is a sovereign immunity, both clause 2 and 3 is a fact-specific determination. And here we made all of these arguments about the facts and so on. All they did, they didn't even make the argument that they're sovereign immune. They just said determine jurisdiction accordingly, and they bear the burden of proof. Now, I heard my friend say on the other side, yeah, we're just contesting the law, not the facts. I think that's exactly what the law of the case doctrine forbids. And as you said, you know, they should assume the risk, having agreed in the Fourth Circuit to one set of rules, to not be able to challenge it again. And Judge Sentell, you said, well, what if the Supreme Court makes a different change in law? That's binding. We absolutely agree with that. The problem for them here is that change in law has to be material. That's what this court's decision in McKesson said. Judge Henderson, you were on that panel. And our point to you is that the Sachs decision it's not about contract, breaches of contract, which are very different for the reasons our brief explains. It's a clause 1 case, not a clause 2 case. And, you know, at the very least, we think for whether you want to call it waiver or law of the case, they should have made some argument about Sachs below. Everything you just heard my friend say in his 18, 19 minutes was something that
the district— I don't see why the Groverman question would be any difference in clause 1 and clause 2. See, I fail to see why Sachs isn't a material decision.
Well, I think the Supreme Court itself, Judge Sentelle, went out of its way in Sachs to say in footnote one, they're only deciding clause one, that there's a lot of unique aspects to each of these clauses. Mm-hmm. And so I at least don't think it's a controlling change.
I don't see how they could consistently come out differently on clause two. If you read the Chief Justice's reasoning on insects.
I very much think, Judge Sentelle, they could because of the difference in the language, because clause one refers to a commercial activity by the foreign state. Clause two is a bit looser. It's an act performed in the United States in connection with a commercial activity.
Yes, Mr. Katyal, but the treatise that you all cite in your brief, which I happened to look up, makes it very clear, this is the Sanchez treatise, makes it very clear that clause two also applies to the defendant's conduct.
Yeah.
It's an act of the defendant. That's what the whole thing is about.
Yeah.
So I don't understand how anybody could think that the Fourth Circuit's interpretation of it, an act of the plaintiff, could be correct.
Judge Jackson, we're not arguing that that isn't a way to satisfy clause two, but nothing in that treatise says it's the only way. And there's a really important textual point that we make in our brief, because clause two refers to a foreign state. This is at our addendum to the brief at page three, which reproduces it. A foreign state shall not be immune from the jurisdiction of courts in any case in which the action is based upon an act performed in the United States in connection with commercial activity elsewhere. The clause there doesn't specify who must perform the act in the United States, whereas clauses one and three do exactly that. Now, to be sure, there just aren't that many clause two cases, but that's because any case in which there is foreign sovereign activity in the United States already meets clause one and sometimes meets clause three. So that's why you just don't have precedent on it, but they don't have a case the other way saying that this wouldn't satisfy it.
Can I just ask you, Mr. Katyal, to entertain my hypothetical with Mr. Morg, because I fear that I don't understand law of the case. It seems to me that the Fourth Circuit, to the extent that law of the case is deciding the same issue in the same way or whatever, mm-hmm. that it's a different issue when immunity is raised during or after trial than it is when immunity is raised testing the allegations of the complaint. Mr. Morag says, oh, yes, I see that, but we don't have any reason to think that the facts were, in fact, different after trial with respect to prong two, which is why we didn't raise it. And why I'm asking whether the district judge was precluded from taking another look at it because of the Fourth Circuit's opinion, setting aside transfer. So my hypothetical assumes we don't have a transfer. The Fourth Circuit says what it says, and then we have a trial, and then Iraq hypothetically says, we are immune, district judge. Is law of the case preventing the district judge from deciding that at that point?
So setting aside waiver, which I think is a separate problem, but just if this were raised somehow to the district court, I think this court's decision in Shirley versus Sebelius back in 2012, and Judges Sentelle and Henderson were on that decision, I think answers that, Judge Jackson, by saying ordinarily law of the case would apply. So long as you had a fulsome legal adjudication and there isn't some massive change in the facts. Here, my friend on the other side is conceding after this long trial, no change in the facts. So now the only question is this a material intervening decision in Sachs? And look, I can imagine some arguments for why it is. I'm not saying it's impossible, but boy, as a matter of prudence and fairness to the district court and to us, that should have been an argument that was made in the district court. They never breathed the word Sachs there. They never breathed the word Nelson, the predecessor case in the Fourth Circuit. So they go and they brief all of this sovereign immunity extensively in the Fourth Circuit. And when it comes to DC, what do they say? That one sentence I gave you, nothing more. And now here we are all litigating, having to try and figure out whether or not Sachs applied, how it changed the law, and so on. There's no precedent for this court going and jumping past waiver and law of the case on something like this. And, you know, this has real world consequences.
And you're linking waiver and law of the case. They're not in the same posture here, are they, Mr. Katyal?
They're two very separate arguments, Your Honor.
Yes.
They both paint in the same exact direction, which is law of the case, I think, as Judge Jackson said. Look, they agreed to the Fourth Circuit.
Are you still willing to say that they come together if one of us at least, and maybe more, would be convinced that waiver is not present?
Oh, law of case would still absolutely be
okay.
Present.
I think you have. Absolutely. Yeah, I think you want. I think you want to delink those.
Excuse me, sorry, I couldn't hear that.
You want to delink them?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. I want to. They are two separate arguments, yeah. As I said, Your Honor, at the outset. And we certainly think Clause 3 is a separate argument as well and requires no remand. They had their bite at the apple to argue all of the direct effects in the district court. They said nada about it. And it's totally unfair now, after we've expended huge amounts in a trial, to say, oh, we now have some Clause 3 arguments. That time to do that was at the trial. The district court found these facts.
Can I just ask you a question? You keep saying we spent all this time, we, OIOC, on this issue before the district court and they said nothing. I'm still wondering why you're spending time on it if that's their burden and if law of the case, the Fourth Circuit has already said there's no immunity. Right. Were you trying to prove to the district court something that you didn't have to because law of the case already took care of it?
100%, Your Honor. It's always their burden, but we, as a matter of belt and suspenders, wanted to be absolutely prudent. As you can imagine, this is one of the most important, this is the most important thing YOAC has ever faced. And so as a matter of careful lawyering, we did that, but we certainly don't think the fact that we developed a record, made all of these arguments, and the district court found them all, including the facts on Clause 3 in our favor, should somehow hurt us and penalize us and mean that they get to reopen things. We've been clear from the very start, from the time this case was in the EDVA, what our arguments have been. Their arguments have shifted, morphed, and changed over time to the point where here we are now, almost two decades later, having to litigate some of this stuff that was once upon a time litigated in the Fourth Circuit, but definitely not litigated below in the district court. And, you know, so they bear the ultimate burden here. I think that's what the precedents of the D.C. Circuit have said time and again.
If there are no more questions, Mr. Kochel, I know we told you that you would have 2 minutes on damages, but I'd like to amend that and say if neither of my colleagues has any questions about the damages, we'd like to take that on the briefs.
No questions.
Judge Jackson?
No questions. Thanks.
All right.
And Judge Henderson, on the cross appeal about the two complementary compensation things, is that included in the question?
Yes.
Your colleagues?
Yes. All right. So, Mr. Morick, why don't you take 2 minutes?
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to make one point on the burden of proof. What you said in Bell Helicopter and what YOAC actually acknowledged itself in its proposed findings of fact was that it had the burden to articulate an FSIA exception that worked on the facts it alleged. And in Bell Helicopter, what you held was the district court did not err in ruling that Bell failed to meet its initial burden. And that even though it had articulated all of these direct effects that it believed occurred in the United States, and you held that because you decided they did not qualify as direct effects. That's the argument we're making. They haven't come forward with a theory of an exception that is legally plausible and that would survive if we said nothing else after that.
Mr. Kochel says that not only have they done that, but that you all said nothing before the district court as they tried. Is that true? And why shouldn't we consider your argument with respect to this, therefore somehow waived about the argument that they haven't done enough?
Your Honor, the issue is unique to subject matter jurisdiction. In the Prince versus Germany case in which Judge Santel, you sat, Germany had raised an argument for the first time on appeal against the district court's subject matter jurisdiction. And this court held that you would consider that belated argument if it were of any consequence to the jurisdictional determination because of the unique fact that subject matter jurisdiction cannot be created by consent, waiver, or estoppel.
Yeah.
That is simply a rule that applies here. There is no forfeiture of arguments that can be possible as long as you accept that we preserve the issue of sovereign immunity. And we did that because there was no unmistakable and unambiguous waiver of that point to satisfy the FSIA. Nelson was cited to the Fourth Circuit. Nelson was cited by the Fourth Circuit. With respect to Sachs not being relevant to clause two, this court in Odhiambo recognized that structurally the based upon phrase applies to all three categories of the commercial activities exception. You applied it again, 2 months ago in JAM versus IFC, you considered the clauses one and two in tandem in doing your based upon analysis. So I think that one's clear. With respect to this issue about no case establishes that the plaintiff's conduct can't be for purposes of clause two, we cited the AAA case. It's in the briefs. It's out of the Sixth Circuit. That's exactly what it holds on this similar record of a U.S. contractor seeking to predicate jurisdiction on its U.S. administrative activities. On the issue of the payment from the request for payment, Judge Santel, you were exactly right. The demand for the payment to the account in the United States was sent by Y-Oak to Zaina. There is no evidence whatsoever that that was communicated to Iraq. Iraq agreed to make payments in Iraq at the office of the Ministry of Defense in Baghdad. So that doesn't count because it's not, as you said, something between the sovereign defendant and the plaintiff.
All right, Mr. Morag, you need to wind it up.
Those are the points I...
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. And Madam Clerk, if you'd call the next case.